Today we're going to talk a bit about government, and it so it's fitting that Larry was praying for our government, and our government certainly needs prayer. Here's the thing for me. I don't know how long we've been doing this civilization project. Several thousand years, probably. If you go back to ancient Egypt, ancient China, we've been working at civilization for a long time, haven't we? We've got lots of things. We've got a lot of technology. We know a lot. I think that maybe we take for granted just where we live, where we are right now. Did you know that if you have any question at all, most people right now can pull a device out and ask that question of the device and access the sum total knowledge pretty much of the world on that particular topic? Does that ever dawn on us? We're like, just spend the time looking at Facebook or whatever we think. We have the whole, you're talking about the Alexandrian Library and the great achievements of civilizations of the past, and we've got it all compressed into something with a 3-inch screen. I mean, that's nuts. And maybe we take it for granted. But here's the thing that I think is interesting about it is as smart as we are and as advanced as we are, we're not quite getting it right yet. We're so stinking smart, but we're $17 trillion in debt. We can fly a remote control airplane and go and just kill a specific enemy halfway across the world that we never meet, but we can't somehow dig out of debt. We can't solve poverty or world hunger. Something has gone wrong with us, and it's not that we just, well, if we just had a little more time, guys, we, you know what? I don't think it's time. I don't think it's education. I don't think the problem is technology. I think the problem is us. Because the smarter we get, the better we get at killing each other. And there's just something wrong, with humanity, I think, fundamentally, and with government as corporately. To my knowledge, there's not been a perfect government that's shown up. And you would think there would be by now, don't you? That somehow we could have somebody who could come up with laws and principles and precepts that somehow we could get along and that people would have opportunity and that they would be educated and that crime would go away. You think that somehow by this time we'd be there, don't you? I was just reading, in Western Europe, and I'm sorry for anybody that's listening on the internet and if you live in Western Europe, but for us over here, we kind of look at them, we say, man, those guys are so stuck up, and you were just over there, but we, at least for us, we think, wow, you think you're so smart, and they are, anytime you want to sound smart, what do? You start picking up the British accent, right? If anyone wants to be credible, you just talk in a British accent and all of a sudden you're an expert, right? And so we know that the people in the UK are much smarter than the rest of us. Right? And I was just seeing on CNN News that the UK has just decided to include proceeds from drug sales and prostitution in their gross national product. That they, we don't want to not report this $17 billion a year in our GDP. I think something's wrong. Here in the 21st century, with all the advantages we have, and we're saying not only are we acknowledging that these things exist, but we're actually celebrating them to some degree. We're adding them to the bottom line of how well we're doing financially. And that the UK is not the first one to do that. Norway's been doing that for a long time, other European countries, and in Nevada, of course, that we have that as well. I see someone fanning, and we've been turning this thing down. I'm going to keep doing it until I feel comfortable. We've been doing that for a while. We got all kinds of privileges, but we're not quite there. And we begin to ask, well, what's wrong? Maybe God, and if from a spiritual standpoint, maybe we ask, well, is God in charge or not? I think that, we can criticize humanity, we can criticize what's wrong with us in our technology, but someone from the outside looking in would say, well, where's your God? What's he up to? Why hasn't he fixed it? And obviously the worldview that's presented in the Bible is that there's something fundamentally broken, that we lost something at the fall. And I think that that's why Christianity probably, well, not probably, Christianity will win in a competition side by side with worldviews because it's the only one that acknowledges that we are made in God's image and we're fundamentally flawed. That the dichotomy of our existence, that the wonders that humanity can achieve is accounted for in the Christian system. And the utter failure that we're all capable of is accounted for in the Christian system. And the Christian system holds both things in equal tension all the time. And I think that's just a beautiful thing, but it also gives hope looking forward. So we ask, where's God as we look at the nations and the turmoil and the uprisings and the failings that happen in our society? And go ahead and give that to me. I want to talk a bit today about kingdoms and the kingdoms of the world. And the first thing I want to note is that, and we're in Isaiah, I was just kind of halfway joking with Jason, we're actually going to be covering Isaiah chapters 1 through 37 this morning. So I hope you're comfortable, hope you brought a snack. We may break for 10 minutes and come back, but we're covering that much, but just hitting the high points along the way, so don't worry. God works out his purpose through the sinful powers. That God is at work in this world. He's at work in the societies, and he's working through the sinful powers, not against them. You know, it's not that God's like, man, if China would get on board, we could finally do something, but that's a God-free zone. It's just too bad there's 1.3 billion people who can't have me in their life because the Chinese government is atheist. You know, God's not standing at the border of China going, hey, boy, I wish I could get in there, man. They would just let me in. You know, we talk about, hey, let God in the schools. Guess what? He's already there. He's there, you know. You're not going to keep him out. And that God, not only is God there, but he is actually working through people who are actually disobedient to him. And that's the great enigma of a sovereign God who's ruling over a fallen world. So in Isaiah chapter 7, and what I love about the book of Isaiah is this wonderful blend of prophecy and history. That Isaiah is speaking into current events and real things that are happening in his world. And at the time Isaiah begins to prophesy, he's there in the reign of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. These are the kings of Judah, the southern kingdom, after the northern kingdom is just on its decline and way out the door. But when Ahaz is ruling, what happens is that the northern kingdom, what's now called Ephraim, forms an alliance with another nation, with the Arameans to the north, and they say, you know, I think things would be better if we could just wipe out those people in Judah, take over all their stuff. And so they do. And they come marching against Jerusalem. And it says, when Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim, so the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken, as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. And so they've received this bad news. You're about to be invaded by a force that's more powerful than you, right? What's God going to do about it? Well, go to chapter 8. Verses 1 through 7a says, the Lord said to me, take a large scroll, this is Isaiah, write on it with an ordinary pen. Maher Shalal Hashbaz. By the way, Mephibosheth is easy. Maher Shalal Hashbaz. So I called in Uriah the priest and Zechariah son of Jerubbekiah as reliable witnesses for me. Then I made love to the prophetess, so we're PG-13 here, as she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said to me, name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz. For before the boy knows how to say my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried off by the king of Assyria. So the name, the reason it's so long is because it's a sentence, right? And the sentence is, or the phrase, is quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. And so he's saying that this force is going to come quickly, and they're going to plunder and they're going to spoil. They're going to plunder and spoil Damascus and Samaria. And so he names this child. Now, you kids, I'm sure you're happy that your parents didn't name you, gee, I wish I could get out of debt, right? It says, the Lord spoke to me again, because this people has rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh and rejoiced over Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Therefore, the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty floodwaters of the Euphrates, the king of Assyria with all his pomp. Who's God going to use to punish these other nations? Assyria. Now, Assyria, if your ancient Near East history is a little rusty, was some of the most brutal, vicious, aggressive people that have been on the planet. They wanted to make sure that if you rebelled against their power, you paid, and you paid publicly.
One of their favorite things to do was to strip the skin off of their enemies while they were alive. And so here's a vicious group of people, and we can say, man, God, where are you? And God's like, oh, I'm here, I'm using them. Really? That kind of, you know, it can mess with our minds. And we can look at governments and we can say, how can this happen? How can that happen? And I think that we have to understand that at the beginning of time, God did something, okay? God did a thing at the very outset of creation. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28, it says, then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock, over all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, over every living creature that moves on the ground. What C.S. Lewis called this was a deep magic from before the beginning of the world. That there is a principle woven into all the created order from before creation, in God's mind, is that humanity will be God's regents on earth. That authority is woven in. That authority is not some aberration. It's not something here to control us. That authority is something here to help us. It's something that God has instituted. That Romans 13 says there's no authority except from God. That God has instituted authority. And God is not the type to renege. That once God sets something up, he leaves it that way. He won't take it away. 1 Corinthians 14:29 says that the gifts and calling of God are unrepented of. See, God won't renege. He won't revoke. Even though we've messed it up, and this is why it was such a strategic move for Satan to hit the created order at humanity. To get us subject to him, because now things can really start going south. You want to destroy something, get the leader. And so creation is built with authority in mind. And so God's not going to renege. He's going to work in those things. He's not going to cancel them. He's going to work in the midst of them. He's going to use one nation to punish another one. And so that's kind of the main point. But the problem with that is, as Lord John Emmerich Edward Dahlberg Acton said, all power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's the problem with that, is that in a fallen world, and I think such an astute observation, that in a fallen world, once someone's given power, they should be mistrusted. I think that's why the U.S. has worked well, because we have a system of checks and balances. We started at the beginning saying we can't trust people with power. That's why it's kind of worked okay, is that we've acknowledged sin in the systems and forms of our government, and that's why it's worked okay until this time. But, you know, there's that erosion that always happens. And so, at any rate, once God gives power and authority, it begins to be corrupt. And so if you continue reading in Isaiah 8, 7b through 10, remember God said, I'm going to send them, they're going to come like a river, they're going to bring my judgment, the Assyrians, it will overflow its channels. He's saying, I'm sending this river to accomplish what I want, but unfortunately this river is subject to sin, and it's going to overflow its channels, it's going to run over its banks and sweep onto Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, Emmanuel. Raise the war cry, you nations, and be shattered. Listen, all you distant lands. Prepare for battle and be shattered. Devise your strategy, but it will be thwarted. Propose your plan, but it will not stand, for God is with us. So he's saying that Assyria is going to be sent, but they're going to disobey, they're going to do some stuff, and then what God's going to do next in Isaiah chapter 10, verses 12 through 17, it says, when the Lord has finished all his work against Mount Zion and Jerusalem, so God's coming to punish Jerusalem for their disobedience, he's going to scare them real bad, he will say, I will punish the king of Assyria for the willful pride of his heart and the haughty look in his eyes. For he says, by the strength of my hand, I've done this. That arrogance begins to creep in. That blessing, as God is just so generous and he wants to pour blessing and use people, but this arrogance comes in and gets in the way. He says, by the strength of my hand, I've done this. By my wisdom, because I have understanding, I removed the boundaries of the nations. I plundered their treasures like a mighty one. I subdued their kings. Does the axe raise itself above the person who swings it? or the saw boast against the one who uses it, as if a rod were to wield the person who lifts it up, or a club brandish the one who is not wood. Therefore, the Lord, the Lord Almighty, will send a wasting disease upon his sturdy warriors. Under his pomp, a fire will be kindled like a blazing flame. The light of Israel will become a fire, their Holy One, a flame. In a single day, it will burn and consume his thorns and his briars. And so God has taken, you see how God has taken Assyria and used them to punish Rezin and Pekah and Damascus and Samaria. He's used them to punish that nation, and now he's going to punish Assyria as well. Next thing I want to notice is that, you know, what do we do in the midst of all of this turmoil? As God is working out his plan through the disobedient cultures and societies that we live among, it says, faith in Emmanuel defies the sinful powers. Did you notice in chapter 8 where he says, it will come into your land, O Emmanuel? Famous messianic passage, Isaiah chapter 7, verses 14 through 16. It says, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel. He will be eating curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. For before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread, that's Rezin, Pekah, Damascus, and Samaria, the land of those two kings that you dread will be laid waste. The Lord will bring on you and on your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. So, first of all, I want to notice that this is primarily talking about Mahershalal Hashbaz. Okay? And we read this passage all the time at Christmas, don't we? You know, the virgin will give birth to a son, and Luke uses it when he talks about the birth of Christ. But I want to be honest and fair and say that this is not primarily talking about some distant person born in a manger. Okay? It's talking primarily about this child that has this really long name. Okay? But it does point forward to somebody else. To someone whose name means God with us. Because Mahershalal Hashbaz was never named that. He was never called it. That this person, and this is just double fulfillment, that so much of what happens in the Old Testament has multiple fulfillments. And this double fulfillment is on someone named Emmanuel, God with us. Well, who is this Emmanuel? We'll go back to chapter 8. And verse 7b, it says, therefore the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty floodwaters of the Euphrates, the king of Assyria. It will flow all of its channels, run over all its banks, sweep into Judah, swirling over around it, passing through it, reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, Emmanuel. Who's Emmanuel? Well, whoever it is, the Holy Land is his. The Jerusalem is his. That Judah is his, not our land, Emmanuel, your land. Whoever it is has sole proprietorship over the Holy Land. Raise the war cry, you nations, and be shattered. Listen, all you distant lands. Prepare for battle and be shattered. Prepare for battle, but it will be thwarted. Propose your plan, but it will not stand, for Emmanuel. God is with us. Whoever it is going to be the defender of Judah and Jerusalem. Whoever Emmanuel is owns Judah and Jerusalem. Whoever Emmanuel is the defender of Judah and Jerusalem. They will cancel every plan of the nations against God's people. Who is that? Jumping all the way to Isaiah 37, verses 9 through 13, we're going to get a little history. It says, now Sennacherib received a report. Sennacherib is the king of Assyria. He's coming. He's besieging Jerusalem. Okay? He says he received a report that Tirkaka, the king of Cush, was marching out to fight against him. When he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah with this word. So he's writing a letter to Hezekiah, or he's sending a message. He says, say to Hezekiah, king of Judah, do not let the God you depend on deceive you when he says, Jerusalem will not be given into the hands of the king of Assyria. Surely you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the countries, destroying them completely. And will you be delivered? Did the gods of the nations that were destroyed by my predecessors deliver them? The gods of Gozan, Haran, Rezeph, and the people of Eden who were in Tel Assar? Where is the king of Hamath or the king of Arpad? Where are the kings of Lair and those rest of those guys? Does that voice sound familiar to you? Have you heard that voice ringing in your ears before? What about all these other people? What about that guy who prayed and he died anyway? What about this guy? He tried something big and it didn't work. You think you can beat me? Does that voice sound familiar to you? It's the voice of doubt, right? It's the voice of Satan. Don't trust God. It's not saying don't believe there is a God. He's saying don't trust him. You can't trust him. You know, this guy, he trafficked in the spiritual realm. He wasn't a modernist, okay? He believed these gods existed. He just thought they were weaker than he was. And he says, don't trust that God that's lying to you. Now, how does Hezekiah respond? Hezekiah received the letter from the messengers and read it. Then he went up to the temple of the Lord and spread it out before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed to the Lord, Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, enthroned between the cherubim, you alone are God. Over all the kingdoms in the earth, you have made heaven and earth. Give ear, Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, Lord, and see. Listen to all the words Sennacherib has sent to ridicule the living God. It is true, Lord, that the Assyrian kings have laid waste all these people and their lands. You know, that voice of doubt has a valid point. He says, it's true. These things have happened. They have thrown their gods into the fire and destroyed them. And they were not gods, but only wood and stone, fashioned by human hands. Now, Lord our God, deliver us from his hand, so that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, Lord, are the only God. Richard Dawkins has an interesting quote, the atheist in the UK. He says, most people in the West are atheists in that they don't believe in any of the gods who've preceded. They just believe in one. He says, we atheists just go one God farther. And yet there is a vast difference, because in a society of mysticism and superstition, you dare not deny the existence of anything that pretends to be a god. That's not safe. Unless you're sure that your God really is the only one. So to dare in an ancient Near East culture to say those gods don't exist is incredibly hazardous unless you are sure that your God is the one and only God, as Hezekiah was. It says, therefore, this is what the Lord says concerning the king of Assyria. God responds, he will not enter this city or shoot an arrow here. He will not consume it before He will not come before it with shield or build a siege ramp against it. By the way that he came, he will return. He will not enter the city, declares the Lord. I will defend this city and save it for my sake, for the sake of David, my servant. Then the angel of the Lord went out and put to death 185,000 in the Assyrian camp. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. There's a lot of discrepancy about what happened to the Assyrian king. Herodotus says that mice ate all their bowstrings and so they gave up. Hey, you can choose what you want to believe. The Assyrian king actually wrote, he has a prism of Sennacherib. By the way, Sennacherib means sin has replaced my brothers. I just thought that was an interesting name. At any rate, he has a prism. Sin was his name of his god. He has a prism, and he only talks about his victories. He says, and I really did some damage to Judah. He doesn't talk about Jerusalem at all. So it says, so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and withdrew. He returned to Nineveh and stayed there. One day, while he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nisroch, his sons Adrammelech and Sharezer killed him with the sword, and they escaped to the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon, his son, his son succeeded him as king. Now, whatever you believe about what happened at the gates of Jerusalem, I want to show you something from Wikipedia, okay? To me, this is a picture of faith in the midst of a fallen world. This is a map You can't see it all or read everything, so I'm going to show you. The dark green is the Assyrian Empire circa 824 BC. The bright green is the Assyrian Empire circa 671 BC, right around the time of the death of Sennacherib, right after. Okay? You may not be able to see it, but there is a pear-shaped yellow island right here, Jerusalem and Judah, that is not under the control of Sennacherib. Babylon fell to Sennacherib. Damascus fell to Sennacherib. Egypt and Ethiopia fell to Sennacherib. That the only people in this entire thing is this little pear-shaped speck of land where Sennacherib had no authority. You remember Isaiah 8? It says that it will overflow its banks. It will flow around you up to your neck. See, God is in charge of everything. And I don't care how you want to explain the fact that the most powerful man on the earth had destroyed everybody and wiped out everything but this little piddly nothing kingdom in the middle of all of this, except that God is the living God and He will not tolerate people defying Him. And the one who went out to defend Israel, do you remember? Did you catch his name? He's called the angel of the Lord. I want you to go home and get on Bible Gateway. I want you to type in the exact phrase, the angel of the Lord. He is a very specific being that occurs in the Old Testament. He speaks with the voice of God, with the authority of God. He makes promises on behalf of God. And when people encounter him, they fall to their faces thanking God that they did not die in his presence. That the angel of the Lord is Yahweh, the messenger of Yahweh, the second person of the Godhead. That the angel of the Lord is the one who stopped Abraham. He called out and he says, "Now I know that you fear God." And he renewed the promises to Abraham, speaking with the voice of Yahweh himself. That the angel of the Lord is the one who met the patriarch Jacob and wrestled with him all night long. Right? The angel of the Lord. And when Jacob realized as the sun was coming up, he says, "Woe to me! I've met God face to face." He named the place Peniel, face of God. I've seen him in his face, and he says, "Before I let you go, tell me your name." And you can see a smile break across this man's face as he says, "Why do you ask my name? I'm not going to tell you that yet." See, the angel of the Lord is the one who met Joshua on the banks, on the opposite banks, on the west banks of the Jordan River, just as he was about to invade Jericho. And he stood with his sword drawn, and he says, "I am the captain of the Lord's host. I'm not for you. I'm not for them. I am for God." That Joshua fell to the ground, and that this man accepted worship from Joshua. He said, "Take your sandals off, because the place where you're standing is holy ground." Why? "Because I'm standing here." That the angel of the Lord is the one who met Manoah, father of Samson. And he ran into Manoah's wife, and he said, "You're going to have a baby." And they said, "Hey, let us offer a sacrifice." And that he accepted this sacrifice, and that he went into the flames and went back to heaven. But before he did, they said, "Please tell us your name." He says, "Why do you ask my name? You want to know his name? It's Emmanuel. God with us. It is Jesus come to save us." That the angel of the Lord, you know, we think of Jesus and we think, "Well, it's too bad he had to die." Did you know that he could by himself destroy 185,000 soldiers fit for war? He didn't have to die. He chose to die. And that by faith in him, in the midst of all of the turmoil, all of the brokenness, that those who have faith that God is with us will stand like that island in the midst of the onslaught and all the turmoil, that God's perfect will is completed in those who have faith. Faith that God is with us. Jesus says this as he's here in the flesh and he's up on the rise and he's looking over his city, the one he defended. "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who sent to you, how long, how often I have longed to gather you as children together." How old was he? 33, 34? How often Not in his earthly life. That's not what he's talking about. As a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. We're not talking about the son of the carpenter here. He's speaking as the second person of the Godhead, as the angel of the Lord, as Emmanuel, God with us. He's saying, I wanted to gather you. You are my precious city, my prized possession, that the angel of the Lord who lived behind the curtain of the temple, the defender of Israel, says, how many times did I want to gather you, but you wouldn't have me? Voice of God, the heart of God, crying out over his people, look, your house is left to you desolate, for I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Emmanuel. But there's another phase to God's work, you see. God's going to get it all. He's going to get it all. Do you remember at the beginning we said that God had delegated authority to humans here in this planet? And that he's been using human authority ever since then? Well, God's not going to leave it that way. It says, Emmanuel will assume the throne of David. Isaiah chapter 9. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. This is in the northern kingdoms. These are the first ones that fell to Assyria. He says, he humbled them in the past, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations. Where did Jesus start out? Where was he? Where did he hail from? Where did he start his ministry? By the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. And those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them. The bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressors, every warrior's boot used in battle, and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning. You see, Jesus coming is the beginning of the end for the world powers. That he is setting up a kingdom that is like no other. A kingdom of peace. It will be fuel for the fire, for unto us a child is born. To us a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor. Get this next name. In a monotheistic culture that will not permit an image of their God by his own command, get this name, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. You see, God himself, he delegated authority to humanity. Humanity wrecked it. Rather than taking that authority back, because that would not be in his nature, has become a human born to us. Mighty God, born a human. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne. Over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. God never forgets a covenant. So God said, Adam, your race will rule this world. He didn't take it back. Then he said, David, you're going to rule over my possession, Jerusalem, through your descendant. He's not going to take it back. That Jesus is the fulfillment of every covenant that God has made. Though humanity has been entirely wayward, God is going to work his plan out. And his son would come, the God-man, born of David, and rule forever. See, this is another problem. Judah would have a good king, they'd have a bad king. Good king, bad king, good king, bad king. Eventually, it all wore them out, and they went away. See, leadership succession is inherently flawed. Jesus didn't give his leadership away. So his kingdom has come. Jesus says this when he came to earth in John Chapter 5, he says, Jesus gave them this answer, very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees the Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son does also. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does. Yes, and he will show him even greater works than these, so that you will be amazed. For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he is pleased to give it. Moreover, now get this, moreover, the Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Very truly I tell you, Whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and will not be judged, but has crossed over from death to life. Very truly, I tell you, a time is coming and has now come when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, he has granted the Son also to have life in himself. Now get this. And he has given him authority to judge because he is the Son of Man. What did Jesus gain by becoming a human? He stepped into the covenant of Adam, and he has become, and so at his resurrection, what does he say? All authority is given to me in heaven and on earth. That Jesus, the God-man, has wed heaven and earth, has stands as the mediator, perfect and capable to judge. The last major point is on the day of the Lord, human power will be overthrown. You see, God has worked through human kingdoms, but he's also set up his kingdom in the midst of those human kingdoms. That his kingdom, like Jesus said, you can't point here or there. There's no geographic boundaries. That the leadership of the Son of God is advancing and moving forward. That of the greatness and the spread of his kingdom, there will be no end. That God has come as a man to be our king, and he has set up his kingdom. Emmanuel rules over us today. But it's in the midst of the kingdoms of this world that that won't continue forever. You see, because God has set a day when he will overthrow all human power. In Isaiah chapter 2, verses 10 through 21, it says, "Go into the rocks, hide in the ground from the fearful presence of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. The eyes of the arrogant will be humbled and human pride brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that is exalted, and they will be humbled. For all the cedars of Lebanon, tall and lofty, and all the oaks of Bashan, for all the towering mountains and all the high hills, for every lofty tower and every fortified wall, for every trading ship and every stately vessel, the arrogance of man will be brought low and human pride humbled. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day, and the idols will totally disappear. People will flee to caves in the rocks and to holes in the ground from the fearful presence of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to shake the earth. And in that day, people will throw away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver, idols of gold, which they have made to worship. They will flee to caverns in the rocks and to the overhanging crags from the fearful presence of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to shake the earth." You see, God will bring it all under his kingdom, under his authority. He alone deserves to be worshipped. He alone deserves all the acknowledgement, all the power. So I'm going to show you this little diagram. Here's what we've said so far. Let's say that this direction is the purposes of God. This line represents the kingdoms of this world. These two rails are judgment. That God will use the peoples of this world, but he will judge them when they overspread their banks. That this is the perfect will of God. It's traveling along this way. That God is never going to be frustrated. He's never going to be thwarted. That this red line is the setting up of the kingdom. That Emmanuel came and set up his kingdom, that he wed heaven and earth, that his authority is marching ahead, and that we are part of that kingdom, those who are of faith in him, and that one day there will come a day when the human power will be done away and God will reign supreme. This is the picture. So let me show you one more thing on this. This span from here to here, this is where we live. This is a day in the eternal timeline. It's one day. And the day has a specific name. You know what day it is? Like the camel, right? What day is it? It's not hump day. It's the day of salvation. As God's co-workers, we urge you not to receive God's grace in vain. For he says, "In the time of my favor, I heard you. In the day of salvation, I helped you. I tell you, now is the time of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation." That we are in a day of salvation, that God has set up his kingdom, that he has announced that his Son reigns supreme, and he says, "This is your time. This is your 24 hours. I'm giving amnesty. You can come on board. You can bend the knee to Jesus. Whatever nation, tribe, and tongue you're from, you can give your allegiance and your heart to Emmanuel. I'm giving you this day. But there's another day coming. It's the day of wrath. It's the day of the Lord that we read about. So what are you going to do in this day? Are you going to come under His authority, or are you going to continue to live in the ways of the world? We know that the ways of the world are broken. History has proved that. We know that the ways of the world are coming to an end. God's Word has announced that. So if you want to cling to those, it's your choice. But now you know all the variables. And what do we do if we're saved people? How do we react to this? Well, Isaiah chapter 2, verse 22 says this: stop trusting in mere humans who have a breath, but a breath in their nostrils. Why hold them in esteem? And a lot of times I think we let ourselves get all weirded out by our boss or by someone who's around us, by what other people think of us. And when that happens, when we want to read the news and fret, or when we want to see the signs of the time and think, oh no, what will happen? When we want to fight over power and over influence and over stuff, when we're tempted to go there, we need to be challenged by these words. Because Jesus has set up His kingdom, and that He alone rules us, and that when we put our faith in Him, I'm not talking about some mental ascent, I'm not talking about filling out a comment card, I'm talking about when everything in your life causes you fear, just like Hezekiah receiving that letter. You take that letter and you hold it before God, and you say, you know what? It's nothing but a thing. Because my God rules, and by faith, I'm going to join Him right here. I'm not going to fall into this mess. This is fear. This is faith. The choice is yours today. Oh, you say, well, I'm afraid anyway. Well, then transfer your fear. Isaiah chapter 8 says this: do not call a conspiracy everything this people calls a conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear, and do not dread it. The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread. There is only one, and that's freedom. Well, I don't know where you're at this morning. That's the message. Whatever headspace you're in, wherever you came, if you say, you know what, I'm tired of living the way of this world. I'm tired of that undulation, those ups and downs. I'm tired of being afraid of what's coming next. I understand that we've messed it up, and it's not going to get fixed on our own. And I'm ready to join Jesus in His kingdom. If you want that, I encourage you to do it today. Today is the day of salvation. If you say, you know what, I gave my life to Christ, but I've been living like a person of this world. I've been reacting to things. I've been letting this world throw me off of my peace and my confidence in the Lord. You need some prayer. You need to regain that. God wants you to have that peace and that joy, that consistency that comes from Him.